I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Whether it's a system failure of a major transit system or the opening of a wrong envelope at the Oscars or even a holiday meal overcooked, we wonder as to how established, complicated systems fail. These are some of the examples found in a fascinating book. I discuss it now with one of its authors, Chris Clearfield. He has written with Andras Tilchuk, Meltdown, Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. It takes social science research and offers riveting stories that take us to various situations when complicated systems, made to simplify work and our lives, fail and cause chaos, even at times risk to safety, in some instances death. There are many examples in the book, from the Gulf of Mexico oil spill to the Volkswagen scandal. I asked Mr. Clearfield about the paradox of progress as well, whether we can simply go back to before when things were seemingly simple. He offers great examples as to how to improve organizations, like encouraging dissent and valuing diversity. Chris Clearfield is a former derivatives trader, a licensed commercial pilot, and a graduate of Harvard University, where he first met his co-author. He has written on complexity and failure for The Guardian, Forbes, and the Harvard Kennedy School of Review. This book is published by Penguin. Visit rethinkrisk.net for more. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Chris Clearfield. Mr. Clearfield, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. We can obviously learn from failure, but a lot of us now are sort of programmed to, say, avoid it. We don't want any hiccups at all. We don't want any problems. And so I guess we've made our lives the way it is to avoid such things. And we've lost, I guess, the ability to learn from failure. I mean, it can be quite instructive, can't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the things that we sort of, with our research for the book, found really interesting, just that, you know, the kind of trick isn't to avoid failure. The trick isn't, you know, to be totally risk averse. The trick is really to try things and fail and sort of go from there, to learn from them. You know, a lot of what we write about is how we can not only learn from failures, but also learn from these kind of near misses.
We lose something, though, don't we, in terms of being resilient? And I'm the same way. I mean, I don't remember phone numbers anymore, and I'm loath to think about what I do in the case of an emergency, because I think I've relied on, say, a device to remember all my numbers. It has changed the way our brains have worked, hasn't it? I mean, these complicated systems.
Yeah, you know, it has, and I would say the other thing that's changed is not just our brains, but just how the world is organized. You know, in everything from, you know, how we get our airline tickets to how things like the power grid work. You know, we're so much more dependent on all of these technologies working well, and I think for us, for our work on Meltdown, you know, that was one of the things that really struck us, that when a lot of this research on how complexity causes failure was done, it was research that, you know, looked at things like nuclear power plants. And what my co-author Andras and I realized more and more as we did our research was that, wow, you know, this kind of complexity is everywhere, from, you know, again, like airlines, to, you know, even the way that kind of our bus passes, you know, store information. And yeah. And so it really made us think like it was a topic, it was an area of the world that was really affecting everybody, because so many of us as you know, even just people working in kind of a normal company, end up managing these kind of big complex systems.
Well, what do you say to people who might say, they could be of a certain age, I'm sure, who say it was much easier when things were less complex way back when? I mean, this is what's fascinating me as I'm reading Meltdown, is this paradox of progress, that we think we've advanced in so many areas, and yet at the same time, something simple to do can be a little more complicated than it was, say, 50 years ago, say.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And that, you know, that's another kind of, I think, one of the themes that struck us as we worked on the book. It wasn't that, you know, our kind of the solution isn't, you know, we're not neo-Luddites, right? The solution isn't to throw out all this technology and, you know, kind of go back to the quote-unquote good old days. It's to realize that, wow, we've got all of these capabilities and, you know, I don't want to overly hammer the example, but airline tickets are a really interesting example of this. You know, the airlines are flying so many more people now than they did when they had, you know, paper tickets. Yeah. And the kind of sort of complex reservation system is part of why that's even possible. But at the same time, you know, we've seen so many instances of whole fleets of airlines that are grounded, not because there's a problem with the plane, but because there's a problem with, you know, the reservation system. Yeah. And so, or the crew scheduling system or something like this. And that's just fascinating. And I think sort of for us, you know, Meltdown was really kind of a two-part process. It's sort of thinking about it. It's sort of the first is we have to recognize where these things are happening in this way. And then the second part is we need to think about not just the ways that we can turn back the clock and simplify our systems, although there is some of that, but really the ways that we need to be better at managing these kind of complex systems so we don't have these big, extensive failures.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about mitigating meltdowns, if you will, in that if there is a problem, well, you can work around it, if you will. And I guess a lot of us just feel that if the whole system at work is down, we're just not going to work that day.
Right, and that works, you know, that works in some industries, right? Yeah. And that works in some areas. And, you know, I think you can think about the sort of changes in the world in a bunch of different ways, but, you know, as we add more technology, we get more capabilities. And I think that, you know, cars are a great example of this, right? I think when we think about not even thinking about driverless cars, just leaving that out of the equation for a minute, but just, you know, our cars now, they can hook up to our phones, you know, a lot of them are internet connected in and of themselves, and that adds some capabilities. You know, it means manufacturers can send these updates to the cars. I mean, there's such an interesting story about Tesla before a hurricane, you know, extending people's ranges so that they could get out of the radius of the hurricane. But the flip side of that is now we have internet-connected cars, and we've taken, you know, a kind of a whole fleet of vehicles that are potentially vulnerable to these big problems, and, you know, now we've connected them to the internet. And so we kind of invite these security challenges even as we add these kind of capabilities. And so I think it's an interesting point. You know, sometimes some of us, we can just stay home or sort of, you know, not show up to work. And that might work in the short term, but if you think about the way that complexity is now part of, you know, so many aspects of our lives and our society, there really are places where we don't have that luxury. We don't have the luxury for things not working for you know, even relatively short periods of time.
As I was telling you before we started, I'm enjoying the book a great deal because there are a lot of fascinating examples in the book systems that accidentally kill people, say, or the bankrupt companies. When you're doing the research for a book like this, how are you not personally, say, shocked or surprised by the things you've come across? Say,
you know, sometimes I was is the honest answer, and I know both Andras and I had this experience. You know, I would do a lot of the research and writing from a coffee shop in my neighborhood. And there were times when I would be researching, you know, aspects of a particular story, and I would just start crying because it was so tragic how these sort of missteps in decision-making affected so many people. I mean, you know, one example that stands out for me is the Flint, Michigan lead poisoning crisis, right, where I mean, you know, the number of people, the number of kids, the community that was affected is so big, and the decision to not sort of treat this as a serious, complex endeavor, and, you know, skip testing and the decisions that were making. I mean, they were such there was such small benefit to being reckless in the way that, and I don't use that word lightly, to being reckless with those decisions. And you know, it's just, it's such a tragedy and such a human tragedy that I think all of us can understand. We imagine our kids in that situation.
Right. How did you and Andrush meet?
You know, actually, we were friends as undergraduates in college. And we went to, we both went to university at Harvard. And we studied very different things. He studied sociology, and then Andrush went on to do his PhD in that. I was a kind of a science nerd. I studied biology and things like that. And you know, we kind of went our own separate ways for a long time. And then we met again later, and we were just kind of chatting and catching up. And it turned out he and I were both thinking about the same kinds of problems about how organizations make decisions, and in particular, how they often make decisions that don't turn out so well. And so we started this very, very interesting and kind of fruitful collaboration together, which has been really, really, really nice.
And so you live in Seattle, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And he's in Toronto. So how did you collaborate in terms of putting this book together, writing this book together?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I will say, you know, kind of back to this idea of the paradox of progress, you know, we collaborated by using tools that weren't available 5 or 10 years ago, interestingly enough. I mean, we use Google Docs to write the whole book, basically. And that's this, you know, platform where that actually added a lot of transparency to our process, because we could each see what the other was seeing on you know, our screens. We did lots of video calling, and we did lots of, you know, kind of going away and working on something and then coming back and working together to sort of shape the prose. So the process was really, first of all, it was very, very richly rewarding working together. I think because we have different perspectives, it was really interesting to see those come together. But then it was also, you know, it was also fun, and the whole process felt sort of novel.
Well, now, you are a pilot, I understand.
That's correct, yes. I fly small airplanes. I'm a commercial pilot, meaning I can get paid for it, although mostly I fly for fun, and then I also teach people.
Yeah.
I teach students how to fly.
So when you do something like that, because that's a significant skill, you know, there are a lot of things that one has to think about when they're flying. You can't just say sort of coast and let your mind wander off. What does that teach you about, say, avoiding catastrophes? Because, I mean, I think that's the one thing nowadays that a lot of people are scared of is flying, because they're afraid that something bad will happen.
Sure, and I would say that, you know, it's a really interesting subject. And in fact, I mean, in some ways, there could be a whole book on, you know, why people are scared about flying, and whether or not, you know, what that sort of says about us as human beings.
Yeah.
Because commercial aviation is, you know, basically the safest activity that mankind has ever undertaken. It's safer than crossing the street. It's safer than driving. And yet we feel this strong kind of connection to some of us to fear when it comes to, you know, flying in the airlines. And I think that's interesting. And one of the things I'll say about the airlines that also applies to people who fly small planes and take that process seriously is that we are, and this actually goes back to your very first question, you know, we're always learning from mistakes that we make and that other people make. So, you know, when there is an accident, right, we as a society really pull out all the stops to understand why that happened, and not just, you know, what was the mechanical event that led to it, but what was the whole sort of, you know, kind of the whole chain of accidents that led to it. What were the mistakes that people made? What were the mistakes that regulators made? You know, was the technology confusing? All of these kind of questions. And so, you know, airline accidents are certainly catastrophic, but the industry as a whole does a really good job of learning from them. But I think that there's something that is a little bit of like one step removed from that really is on point with your question about how do we learn from these failures, is that commercial aviation does an amazing job of tracking all of these small failures, all of these near misses, all of these things that could have become catastrophes, and they also learn from those as well. Yeah, every airline has their own program to kind of track and learn from near misses. And the industry as a whole also does that, both in kind of different nations, but also internationally. It's a very learning-oriented industry. And I think one of the things that we learned with research from the book is that, you know, that's a very operational discipline. So if you're not, you know, if you're not running a manufacturing plant or, you know, something that's kind of operational, you might not necessarily see how that kind of lesson applies. But one of the things we learned in the book is that there's lots of really interesting stories of companies applying this in a way that is much softer, right? So not operationally oriented, but just understanding, you know, how different managers might have challenges that they need to be helped with, how different groups are sharing information or not sharing information, as the case may be. And that was really interesting, too, that this kind of practice that, you know, the airlines do very successfully and that seems so operational, that's actually something that, you know, we could all start doing tomorrow in our jobs or even in our families.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's another part of the book that I found fascinating, is that dissent is necessary in any organization. But we're generally averse to that. We don't like criticism. And so what do you
right.
suggest in terms of say, encouraging people to speak up and speak out?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think, really, you know, there's been really interesting brain research about what it feels like to disagree with somebody, what it feels like to kind of draw your own conclusions. And it turns out it's a lot like the same feeling that we would get if, you know, we were walking along hiking and suddenly a bear appeared. We have that real fight or flight response
mm-hmm.
when we disagree with someone. And, you know, humans are fundamentally these very social creatures. And so that's not too surprising that we sort of have this, you know, kind of biological response to dissent built into us. I would take your question and kind of run with it a little bit and say, you know, it turns out in many situations, it's not that we need to encourage people to speak up. It's that we need to encourage leaders to listen.
Mm.
We need to encourage leaders not just to pay lip service to dissent, but to really embrace it. You know, there's a story in the book that I just love about a sailor who is on an aircraft carrier who loses a tool on the deck during this big exercise. And, you know, there's planes landing and taking off everywhere, and it's kind of a dangerous situation. You know, this tool could get sucked up in a jet engine.
Yeah.
So he goes and he confesses that he's lost this tool, and they have to call the whole exercise off, and planes have to go other places and land, and it's, you know, it's a big deal. They scour the deck, they find the tool. The next day, the ship holds a ceremony to celebrate that sailor for his bravery in reporting his mistake. And, you know, that's, to me, that's the tone that we all need to be setting in our organizations as leaders. We need to be celebrating it when people speak up, celebrating it when people disagree with our conclusions, even if they turn out to be wrong or even if they've made a mistake. And it's really only by doing that do we have a chance of getting that kind of information about these big failures before they happen. And it turns out that that's a really powerful way to kind of get ahead of you know, these kind of challenges that we have in our system.
Yeah. But there is the challenge, though, of any organization in terms of having to shift common thinking within an organization that could be, say, years in practice. So
yeah.
Adapting is tough and complexity, I mean, you know, that's not usually suggested because, as I said earlier, I mean, everyone wants everything easy. So what do you suggest
right.
then in terms of say, for companies in terms of having to embark on change? I mean, there are easy things that we can do in our own lives, but for a company, it's a little harder, isn't it?
I would say it is challenging as a company. You know, I'll give you an example of a company that we've been doing some work with. Their chief technology officer brought us in. This company, like many companies, they have a process that they run when something goes wrong. They run a postmortem.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, looks at these kind of failures after they happen. And, you know, some of that sort of, they're a software company, so some of that sort of software specific, but they also look at kind of bigger picture issues. And what they realized is that, you know, they have this process, but they're not quite getting the insights that they want from it. And so one of the things we're working with them to do is to make it so the output of that process isn't just, you know, okay, well, we need to fix this issue with a database, or, you know, we have this problematic piece of code that has come up over and over again. You know, the issues are sort of, to some extent, bigger picture. And the nice thing about these failures is that they can learn things about the ways their organization isn't working. And by creating this sort of culture of kind of blameless accountability, or sort of, you know, looking not at, well, was this somebody's fault? You know, let's fire them or reassign them, but instead looking more broadly at kind of the what are the factors that led to that? They've really been able to make some steps to sort of shift their culture, and I think that can be really powerful.
And so with your work today, and I'm assuming you're working with various companies, different companies, I should say, different sizes and the sort.
Yep.
Are you finding that these companies, large or small, are willing to, say, look at things differently?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the most exciting things about the reception we've had to the book. You know, there are people know that the world has changed. People know that things have shifted and gotten more complex. And you know, I think the kind of, but it's hard to know what the first step to take to sort of deal with that kind of challenge is. And the people that we've worked with, the companies that we've worked with, they're often companies who have kind of an idea that they want to shift something, or that they want to get better, or they've seen a competitor with a big problem, or they've seen that they want more diversity, both in kind of professional backgrounds, but also, you know, in race and gender and these kind of surface level things, for the people they're hiring. And so kind of they come in with the sort of, with the idea that this is something they want to do. And one of the things that's been really great with the research that we've done in the book is we can help them with some sort of scaffolding for how this will work in their organization, how they can create learning in their organization, both when they have, you know, in the case where they have big failures, but also in the case where they have, you know, small things that they notice day to day that might give them clues to avoid these kind of big failures. And so I think that there's a you know, a powerful set of things we can do. That the trick is that they're pretty simple, but that doesn't mean that they're easy. And so it's kind of finding the balance of helping with the willing implementation of these things, if that makes sense.
You made mention to diversity a moment ago, and you know, that's something that we were all thinking about in terms of the need of it. I mean, the benefit of having a diverse team, say, in a corporation. I mean, that's just seemingly a no-brainer. So what do you suggest to companies to make it happen and happen quickly? Because I think we look at institutions large and small, and the ones that fail badly are ones that have failed in terms of having, say, a diverse, and I'm not just talking about, you know, race and gender, but I mean even age,
totally
different people, and, you know, different backgrounds and the sort. I mean, what do you suggest in terms of say making that happen faster?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think it's really kind of a two-pronged answer. I think part of it is to realize what diversity gets us, and also that diversity is challenging. You know, the what the research shows is that the reason diversity works is because it creates these speed bumps. It sort of makes people slow down and be willing to kind of question each other's assumptions. So it creates a little bit of friction in organizations, but that's exactly what we need in kind of complex systems where we're making these high stakes decisions where it's too easy to sort of go along to get along. It's too easy to kind of even accidentally buy into groupthink and only look at a problem in one way. So I think the first thing is to recognize that diversity is a great tool, but its strength comes not from, you know, creating this kind of blend of diverse perspectives necessarily, but the research shows it really comes from creating this friction, and then that friction actually makes our decisions better. It gets us to consider more information and things like that. The other thing that I think is the kind of second prong of the answer is we need to look at what the research shows actually works in terms of what helps us not just hire a more diverse group, but also get diversity in management, promote diverse leaders, you know, get people higher up the chain, sort of help diversity move up the hierarchy of an organization. And, I mean, the good news is that there is actually quite a bit of data and quite a bit of great research, all of which comes from the U.S., but probably applies in a North American context more broadly, about how we get diversity, how we get managers to support diversity. And, you know, if there's one key takeaway, it's to encourage diversity by kind of getting people to buy into it, by helping managers use diversity to almost kind of burnish their self-image rather than make it a control issue. So things like, you know, quotas sort of formal grievance processes don't necessarily work. But what does work is creating opportunities for managers to buy in and to sort of, you know, burnish their self-identities as someone who supports and appreciates diversity. It's sort of buy-in rather than control that actually helps move the needle on diversity, and it can be relatively rapid. There's lots of other things, too, like running formal mentorship programs and things like that, so you don't have kind of a bias of who decides to do mentorship, and you can kind of pair people with who they need to. So, you know, all that's really, really interesting and can be really powerful.
It's not a long book, Meltdown, but there's so much stuff in here that I could talk all afternoon with you. I so appreciate your time today. This is such an important book that people should read because, I mean, as I said, I mean, I'm reading it, and as I'm reading it, I mean, there's so many fascinating examples that you both provide in the book that it just made for an overall enjoyable read. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your time and your thoughtful questions. So I'm really glad we could chat. Thank you.
The book is called Meltdown: Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. It's published by Penguin. One of its authors, Chris Clearfield, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver last week. I'm Joseph Planta.